Mario Acevedo is the best-selling author of Werewolf Smackdown, Jailbait Zombie, The Nymphos of Rocky Flats, and other novels in the Felix Gomez Vampire Detective series. A former infantry and aviation officer, engineer, and art teacher to incarcerated felons, he lives and writes in Denver, Colorado. Mario was the Toastmaster at this year's Mile High Con.
So Werewolf Smackdown, that's the fifth and most recent book in your Felix Gomez series. Yes. What can readers expect next?
You know, right now, I'm working on a YA novel. And my agent has seen it. He liked it. But it was a proposal, so he wants me to finish it. And there's been a couple editors that said that they were interested in it. So I got to finish the darn thing.
So it's the downside of writing something that people like.
Yeah. You got to actually produce something. Those things don't write themselves. So that's what's going on right now.
Can we talk about what it's about?
Okay. It's called Frank and Dad and Son. Like I said, it's young adult. It's about the Frankensteins in today's world, but it's more of a definitely a very satiric story. It's the University of Doom. That's
where the very nice.
Yeah, and it's the Frankenstein.
I think I attended that one.
Frankenstein is it a professor there? He's a doctor, Dr. Frankenstein, and he teaches. And anyway, he gets booted out by. People don't like him. So he and his son are living in suburbia, and they're like a fish out of water because they're evil geniuses. And then the young son, and mainly this is a story of the young son, Alfonso, he's in middle school, and he's having to deal with regular kids, and he's used to being around budding evil geniuses and things. And he has some difficulties, merging with them. So the story's about that, and it's a lot of fun.
So it sounds like it's your kind of signature blend of humor and like the kind of fantasy elements.
Yeah, but I've also got some really dark stories that I'm also working on too. That are not. I don't know if I should put them under a pen name, but they're differently.
This is outside of the Felix Gomez.
Oh, definitely then? Outside of Felix Gomez. One is a detective story about a guy who gets his tongue cut out, and then he has to. Then his daughter gets kidnapped by the guy who cut his tongue out, and. So it's pretty dark that way.
So that's just a straight like crime novel?
Yeah, it's a straight crime novel here. And then the other one that I've been kicking around is really dark. It's about a more science fiction story about giant spiders.
Very nice.
And there's some awesome scenes, and my critique group has read some of the scenes, and like they're from the point of view of the victims of these spiders. I mean, these spiders are the size of Rottweilers, and it was a lot of fun.
No one could possibly be scared about something like that.
It was really cool because you read how spiders prey, and then imagine being a person like that, and the victim and this thing, and then you're paralyzed. You can't even blink your eyes, and you're glued to the ceiling, and then you go watch the spider pick off your kids as they come home and glue them to the ceiling. And then you watch your kid, the spider lays an egg in the kid, and then your kid gets all bloated.
We're in a dark part of your mind.
Yeah, definitely. So
it sounds like you're moving a little bit away from the Felix Gomez series.
Well, right now the Felix Gomez is in a holding pattern. There are some things in the story and some readers want resolved, so I definitely have to go back to that. So Felix is still out there.
Yeah.
He's getting momentum, I like to say.
Yeah.
So actually, can we touch on, you mentioned the critique group, and Gene was telling us about that as well. So can you tell us how you got into that critique group and how it's influenced you?
Okay. Well, I like to tell people that I think that one of the turning points in my career, as it were, as a writer was joining the Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers, because a long time ago I decided I wanted to write a novel, and I was just like spinning my wheels and doing things on my own. And then I moved to Denver, and then shortly after I moved to Denver, I found out about the Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers, and I attended a workshop on running a synopsis, because I had sent out a query letter with a synopsis, and the agent, of course, said no, but he says, what you really need to work on is your synopsis. So I said, okay, that's good to know. And then I was looking at that, and at that time, Westward had a lot more comprehensive in their announcements of things, and they said that Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers had this workshop on synopsis. So I decided to go there, and I met some people. And there was a guy by the name of Jim Cole, who was running this critique group in Morrison. So he invited me to join the critique group, and wow, that was '96. That's a while back. and just show you how fast things move in the publishing world. And then in that critique group, I ended up meeting Gene. So Gene and I, since then, Jim has left the group, and I think Gene and I are probably one of the first people from way back then that are still in this group. We meet, there's eight of us, and we meet at the Pearl Street Grill. Instead of meeting at somebody's house, we meet at the Pearl Street Grill.
That's the way to do it.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. So we can order, you know, we can have happy hour.
Yeah.
It's coincidentally, we meet there at happy hour. So we go there, and we have dinner, and we meet once a week, which is actually, most critique groups meet like every other week. And then we meet every other week, so we're
so you're constantly pushed to have
constantly pushed. It's really good being in a critique group, particularly with being in the right critique group. If they understand where you're writing, what you're writing, where you're coming from, and then they all understand the basics of writing, and also people understand that it is a critique group. It's not a hand holding session,
right?
And if something doesn't work, we can tell you it doesn't work, and this is why, and it's not personal. Sometimes we make it personal just for grins, but we understand that we all got along well, and it's interesting how everybody has their own little thing that they always critique on, and you keep that in the back of your mind. The other hand is one of the things that we also have to constantly remind ourselves is that we're not writing for the critique group, and not let the critique group. It's not a committee thing, mm-hmm. right? And to take risks and take chances and because we don't want to just sort of get into a group think and then come up to a narrower definition of what we think is good writing when we're wrong, you know, we could be wrong. So we constantly want to say, you know, I need to break away from that and take what we say with a grain of salt. Yeah.
So you mentioned that everyone has their own thing that they critique on. What's yours?
What do I look on? You know, I try to really hone in on maybe some story elements. Because one of the things that I got from my editor was always when you write, when you go back and edit, is to look at the underlying. What's the underlying story behind you? You have the big story, but what's really driving things underneath that? And to maybe look at that in when somebody's writing, in that just don't stay superficial. It's to look beneath that, you know. But it's writing is what I mean. That I think that's what writing is, such a unique profession, in that, you know, it's not like craft. I mean, there's a craft part to it, but it's not like, you know, you're gonna make a chair, right? And you can make one great chair, and then you can make another great chair, and then people expect you to make all these great chairs that are exactly the same, and that's what they expect. But in writing, is that, you know, you can't get formulaic, you know. You also gotta push things, but at the same time, you gotta satisfy what the readers want, and you know, what is that? And sometimes you don't know.
As you're working on your books now, do you sometimes hear the voices of the people in your critique group as you're typing things out, going, I know Jeannie's going to say this?
You know, no. Usually sometimes in the editing, yeah. I'll go through that. And it's not that I say, Jeannie's going to say this, because I'll ignore whatever she says. But I do sometimes think that, and sometimes you have to put a damper on that, because I'm like, this is what I think this person is going to say about this. And sometimes I'm wrong, okay? But I think sometimes when they hone in on things, it's because I got lazy. Mm. And it's not because they were particularly picky. It's because I wasn't as hard on myself as I should have been.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So at the Smoky Hill Library, which is where Nick and I work, we recently found several of your books with the covers torn off. And the contents missing, and presumably someone decided they really wanted those books. And I think sometimes people think that we have an RFID chip in the barcode. So I guess my question is, what makes your fans such passionate devotees of your work?
You know, I'm glad to hear that. I need more fans. Yeah. That's what I need.
I was like, at first, I was like, I can't believe someone would, hey, Mario Acevedo.
You know, I don't know. I don't know why anybody would do that.
But really,
you know, I try to write a book that'll satisfy the reader.
Yeah.
you know, I do try to do the best that I can. I understand that they're not going to reach all readers. But every once in a while I get an email or something, some fan mail, and I go, oh, they got it. They got it. Nice. They got it.
Yeah.
And you know, I sometimes get invited to go speak at these literary kind of panels and stuff, and I always try to keep things for my work really. I tell them, look, all I want to do is write an enjoyable read. It's entertainment.
Yeah.
That's primarily what it is. But I think in order to satisfy the reader, there has to be a little bit more to it to make the book a media read. You know, maybe some people get it, some people don't.
Is that why so much of your writing has a really strong humorous element to it?
No, I'm just a smartass.
That's just your personality coming through.
I'm just a personality.
Do you think that's neglected in your genre, like what? In the sci-fi fantasy humor, like that thread of humor?
Well, I'm not going to say it's neglected because it's what people read what they want to read. I mean, the urban fantasy field, which didn't really exist when I first started writing. Mm-hmm. Because people come up to me and go, Mario, you wrote this book when the vampire genre was just taking off? Man, that was so lucky. And I'm like, I just pulled that out of my ass. And it's just all timing. It's all coincidental.
Yeah, yeah.
And what was the question again here? What's
that? Like the thread of humor.
Oh, the thread of humor. You know, and for me, and I'll give you a big secret, is that growing up, I did not like writing. Reading fantasy vampire books. I thought vampire movies, I didn't like them. Now I like them more than I used to because I kind of appreciate them. But back then, I just, the whole notion of vampires, I didn't find that scary. Monsters, zombies, I didn't find that scary at all. Nazis, I found scary.
It seems reasonable.
Yeah, thugs, yeah. Guys like that, I found scary.
Yeah.
You know, the original Vlad the Impaler, I mean, gee whiz. Right. I mean, that's horrible to read about that.
Right.
You know, so, you know, vampires rising from the dead and all that, I didn't get. And the movies back then especially had the cheesy special effects and things. So, you know, they didn't scare me. You know, the creature from the Black Lagoon, I could always see the zipper in the back of his suit, you know. I just,
but that didn't add to the fun for you? Or?
You know, I didn't even think it was fun. Yeah. I just thought it was stupid. And I go, you know, you got this creature there, this monster.
Yeah.
And why don't people blow them up? And the monster movies I did like were
practical.
Well, the monster movies I did like were the ones where they could kill the monsters, like the movie Them, remember with the giant ants? Mm-hmm. They could shoot the ants with machine guns, and they went in there with flamethrowers and all that. And so, but the thing is that what I like, so that was that element, the kind of like that realistic element to that, and I could buy into that, the whole deal of the giant, the radiation, the giant ants. But they acted like ants, and they were flying around. And the thing is that people didn't believe they were there until they actually find you. And I thought that was pretty cool. It was a couple of, and there's a movie, one with a giant tarantula. It was actually the first movie with Clint Eastwood. Because they, in the end of the movie, they drop napalm on the giant tarantula. And it's a fire-breathing tarantula. It's a stupid movie. But at least they killed it with napalm. And then Clint Eastwood is the pilot of the plane coming
in. That's how his career got on.
That's how his career got started, awesome. Right? And,
so are some of these old monster movies like inspiring your newest writing? You know,
not really. No, no.
What was a turning point then for you? If you grew up not really into the fantasy, not really into the vampire stuff, what made you sit down and go, hey, I want to write a vampire book?
Well, exactly what happened was that I was trying to write straight mystery, and that's what I really like, my straight mystery stories. And I worked at Rocky Flats at the time, and this I was sharing a cubicle, and this woman goes, Mario, you like to write? Why don't you write a story about Rocky Flats? And I go, I hadn't thought of that. And I go, well, okay, I'll write a story about an outbreak of nymphomania at Rocky Flats. And she goes, that's already happened. And I go, what are you talking about? So she started telling me all these stories about people, they found people having sex like in the conference rooms and in different security areas on site and stuff. So I go, okay, well, how about a story about a vampire detective investigates an outbreak of nymphomania at Rocky Flats? And she goes, I don't think that's happened. So then I go, okay, so that was actually the germ of the story right there. And then I started to go, and then what happened was is that I had this story previous to that that I really liked and I was sure I was going to sell, and I couldn't even get a rejection on it later on. So I said, the hell with it. I'm going to write the most ridiculous story I can think of, which is a vampire detective investigates an outbreak in lymphomania. And I was so ridiculous that this agent that I pitched it to goes, that's different.
Yeah.
That's
different. It really caught people's attention. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So that's what I
mean. So that's interesting, because so much of the conventional wisdom seems to be, hey, you need to sell yourself, and I'm like this. I'm like what's successful, but you found a completely different road to it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I don't know if there's a lesson to that, but yeah. Very thanks. Cool. Okay.
Let's go with this. So with like there was a recent re-release of Fright Night and a couple of other entries into the vampire genre that are sort of taking back the vampire genre from like the sort of broody romance genre that kind of Twilight took it to. Do you think that your Felix Gomez novels are doing like a similar service to the genre?
No, I don't think, no, because my the original premise of the vampires is monster. Mm-hmm. And Felix is not a monster. He's a blood-sucking killer, but he's not a monster. And he has a moral center to himself, and he has a code of honor and ethics, which actually gets stronger and stronger by every book. But he's definitely not broody, and he's definitely not romancy kind of guy. Because he can never figure it out. Right. Women always, he always gets thumped in every story.
Yeah.
So, I mean, besides, I did my own take on it. You know, I'm not the guy who sets the standard on that thing.
Do you have any particular feelings in terms of the vampire family of stories? It's like, oh, Twilight can be its own thing, or it's like, oh, why do they make vampires look like that way?
Well, I tell you, there's a lot of people who have a lot of heartache with Stephanie Meyer. But the thing is that one of the things that you have to do if you're writing novels is to resonate with your readers, and that's exactly what she did. So, I mean, how can I fault her for doing exactly what they tell us to do? And it worked out for her. So maybe everybody else was missing the boat. You know? maybe the world was waiting for sparkly, broody vampires. You know, and apparently they were. You know, adolescent girls. That's what they wanted, and she gave it to them.
So you said you're working on a YA novel now, and you described it a little bit. How do you approach a YA novel differently from your other work?
That's interesting, because I think that what the expectation is now, it has to be very fast paced. It has to be kind of, the language has to be accessible. But you know, when I look back. When I was growing up, you know, I was reading Michael Crichton when I was 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. You know, so when I was growing up, I cannot think that back then they didn't even have a YA genre.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot think of a book that I read that they people said, well, you know, you're 12 or 13, you should read this kind of book. I'm like, I don't want to read that. I'll read this. You know, Michael Crichton and Arthur C. Clarke and John D. MacDonald, if you guys are familiar with him. You know, so I was reading. I guess what they said, it was adult type stories.
Right, right.
But the YA genre has grown. It's a real big force. It's the largest, you know, and there's a lot of turmoil in the publishing industry. But the YA field has grown the strongest. Yes. And a lot of authors are seeing that as a way to kind of pin their careers on that. Even guys who just write straight mystery and thrillers are not going that way too.
Do you feel like you were able to write this YA book in a way that would have appealed to yourself at that age?
You know, I hope so. It's got a lot of humor in it. It's got a lot of... it's got kind of the humor, I think, like you would see in a Pixar movie.
Okay.
You know, that kind of humor.
Kind of a mature, understated.
Some mature, understated things. And the main character, sometimes it goes over his head because he's 13. And he's kind of a nerdy guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, hopefully a lot of that stuff comes through.
Very cool.
So you recently collaborated on a Felix Gomez graphic novel, Killing the Chinatown Trollop. So what challenges did you face in that particular medium? And have you considered doing any other forays into the graphic novel world?
Well, that fell into my lap. The publisher there, Chris Riel, read my books, and he goes, hey, I really like your character. Let's do a graphic novel on it. And so he knew quite a bit of the story already when he came to me. And I said, well... Sure, yeah. The collaboration was, I wrote the script. The editors there, it's a different kind of a process. It's a lot faster paced than with novels, and they actually want a lot of input with you, like right away. And they are very detail oriented. I had to learn how to write a script for a graphic novel, but they provide you with examples and that. And actually, when that thing came to me, I'd actually been thinking about writing it. So I actually had some books about graphic novels that I had in mind. So that helped me out as well. The artist, I got to work with the artist, and I got to get very detailed, a lot of descriptions that they could use. So it was a really good experience for me, something I enjoyed doing.
We were actually talking with Stephen Graham Jones about this and his foray into it. Did it play with your sense of timing or tension or anything like that, where in a novel form you can just, you write, it happens, but in terms of splash pages, in terms
yeah,
of...
Oh, yeah, the, yeah, definitely, panel, definitely. Like, yeah. And it made me go back and look at other comics to see how things are done. You know, and that's another thing. When growing up, I mean, there was a few comics that I didn't like, but I was really never like a comic nerd or anything like that and collected them. So that was... That was something I had to really look at and kind of study. And it's kind of interesting thinking about studying comics.
Yeah,
when I was in school, who's going to look at comics? And now they're a big thing, mm-hmm. Big moneymaker in that. So that was a good process. Yeah, exactly that. Tension. And then how much the reader, it's a different way of reading something, of experiencing something, because you got the picture. And then sometimes the way the eye is drawn around the page and the images and the drawings is that, and the reader, that's exactly what the reader wants. And then they're not just going to zip through the text. They want to linger over the pictures, and that's, so that's the challenge in that. And then fortunately, the artists that I got teamed with were very experienced. They knew exactly that. And then when I would describe something, they would interpret it their way, but they interpreted it based on their experience, and I was really pleased by what they'd done.
And did you feel that was a portion that you had to, like, give up? Okay, I'm going to trust it, I'm going to let go? Or were there a couple times where you're like, well, I don't know if that's really what I was going for.
Yeah, there was a couple of times with that, but I had to respect them, that they knew what they were doing, and I didn't want to be this kind of guy who micromanaged things, because I said, I have in my mind this is what it's going to look like, and it comes back looking different, but I go, but it's the same effect. So I had to trust them.
Go ahead.
So I saw on your website you have a couple of links to independent bookstores, including Tattered Cover.
Right.
So, like, in the age of e-readers, how do you think independent bookstore can survive, and do you think it can stem from making connections with authors such as yourself?
Well, I think the author bookseller connection today has to be stronger than what it's ever been because of the pressures that they face, and then they need each other. It's interesting in that they're talking about the death of independent booksellers, and this is something that we authors always track because we're very nervous about this, our careers. And actually, there's more independent bookstores now than there were in 2008 was when they bottomed out because a lot of them closing. Now they're the numbers are growing again. Borders closed, and that was a huge, huge hit. But a lot of independent bookstores are now taking up the slack, and independent bookstores have to be niche oriented. They have to be very, very quick, and I think they're able to respond better to the demands of the changes, the technology, and how so they have to be a lot more creative in surviving. But they're doing it. And Tattered Cover is doing a lot of different things, and Who Else Books is doing some things to survive. So.
So you mentioned the borders closures. Did you feel somewhat safe from that? Were you compartmentalized enough away from that, or did that affect you directly?
No, I was compartmentalized away, but it does affect us because one of the things that somebody mentioned was, like, an author's advance is based on sales. Mm-hmm. How many sales? Well, right now, with borders, you lost like a quarter of the shelf space.
Yeah.
And that is going to be reflected, and they say that's probably going to be reflected directly on advances in the future because you've lost one-fourth.
Very interesting. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about, upcoming projects you're excited about, things in the next couple months that you're going to be releasing or doing? Or?
Well, I mean, I am working on my latest newsletter, The Hollow Fang. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks I'll have that coming out. That's always a lot of fun. Kind of a cheesy thing, but it's always cool. I'm getting some authors to contribute to that. You know, finish up my young adult. Yep. My goal is to get that done by Christmas. And then hopefully January, we'll February.
See that
next year? You know, well, January, February, send it out. And excellent. Then if anything happens, if anything bites, you know, it'll still be a while before it happens. But keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
And then if you guys see me in a street corner holding up a sign, you can go, hey, Mario, how's that career doing?
How's that running? Guess that why that book didn't come out after.
Yeah.
Can you sign this for me?
Pardon me?
And can you sign this
for me? Yeah, can you sign this for me?
Good luck.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you.
It's a pleasure and honor to have you here.
Yeah, no, Mike. Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.